I want to welcome you to our biggest, baddest, bestest Black Hat ever. I always like saying that every year, but this year it actually really, really is. We've never done this before. It's kind of cool. And as you can see, we probably have over, well, this room will seat 3,000, but nobody's all awake yet. But we're also simulcasting this in some of the other rooms as well, so there might be people at the very end of the hallway who are also going to be seeing Ian's keynote talk this morning. I've got all these pages of stuff to go through and not a whole lot of time because Ian's such a good speaker. I want to give him as much as he's got to work with. So let me just zoom through this real quick. We've got some new tricks up our sleeve this year for Black Hat, you may have noticed. We've been doing webcasts online recently. It's something new that we haven't done before, but I've always wanted to do. We did some previews of Black Hat, and then we're going to do some best of speeches after the show. And we figure about 10 times a year or so, we're going to do some webcasts to try to keep content from Black Hat alive all year long and also focus on some hot topics like when Dan Kaminsky DNS Flaw came out. That was a perfect venue to kind of get the spotlight on that really quickly. So look to Black Hat in the future to have some more webcasts. You might have noticed if you tried logging into the wireless network, we have this big disclaimer now. What we're doing is the wall of sheep have come over from DEF CON, and we're using them to monitor the network. And what they're looking for is clear text, usernames, and passwords. They don't decrypt anything. They don't do anything, any cracking of any passwords. They're just trying to figure out if people are still using FTP and, you know, Telnet. And if you are, they'll obfuscate your username and password, and they'll humiliate you up on the screen. And hopefully you can go over there and they have backtrack CDs, they have different sniffing tools, they'll teach you how to sniff traffic, show you what's coming out of your machine, kind of be not only a tutorial, it's also a way to raise awareness about insecure network protocols. And, well, we've had a lot of those this year. Also, we've got a Twitter feed. I'm not a huge Twitter fan myself, but it's turning out to be a really good tool for this show. If you go and join the Black Hat USA 2008 Twitter feed, you can see just tons of people talking about what they're doing and where they're going. It's a great way to find parties and meet up with everybody. Also this year, we've got two lunch options. We've got this boxed lunch, which is the fast option. You can stay here. You've got wireless access. If you just need to grab some food and hang out with some friends, you can do that. We also have a plated lunch option, which is the traditional Black Hat lunch, in the tent at the front of the property. Not in the back. They've knocked that whole building down. It's gone. It'll be back next year. Only in Vegas they can make buildings disappear and reappear in 1 year. You can swap tickets. So if your badge says you've got a plated lunch and you really want a boxed lunch, you can just swap tickets with someone. I'm kind of curious to see if this will create an underground economy in tickets. Also this year, we've got an RFID card in with your badge. All it has is a unique identifier. It doesn't have any personal information on it. And what happens is instead of the old barcodes for lead retrieval at some of the sponsors, it just spits out a unique identifier. And then after the show, we correlate that with whatever would be on your business card. So that's your email address, cell phone, company, title, position. We don't give away any home information or billing information or anything. And so that way, even if somebody does run around and sniff all the RFID cards, all they're going to get is a bunch of unique numbers that don't do them any good. So we have thought about that. Okay, so what a year it's been. It's been kind of a crazy year in the industry. For us, we implemented a new call for paper system that Dominique wrote for us. And what it allowed us to do is all the people who signed up early and paid, you guys could review all the CFPs coming into our system and you could vote and give us feedback from kind of lame to hot, what you thought was a good talk. And what that allowed us to do is sort of crowdsource some of the selection and draw our attention to topics that maybe we weren't really thinking of. And it worked really, really well. We have some of the best content, I think, that we've had for a long, long time. And I'd like to say a lot of that is partially thanks to you guys reviewing it and drawing our attention to maybe some speakers we weren't fully aware of and didn't have time to research, but you guys did. That was really, really nice. Let's see. What else can I say? The CFP voting system is sort of in beta. And when I say that, it's sort of in the Google sense. It's a rolling beta. It's a never-ending beta. But in the future, if you do plan to come to Black Hat, sign up early and start participating in the selection process. It really helps us out. We take all that feedback really seriously. Also, I would say that I'm trying to draw some attention to the wireless issues and some hardware hacking issues. Web app security and normal AppSec stuff and secure development lifecycle and all of that stuff is very, very critical, and it continues to be the predominant share of the content you'll see here. But instead of just filling up every track with app security stuff, I wanted to try to go in different directions. And you'll see that there's a pretty good sampling of weird wireless stuff going on out there, especially in hardware security. There's a lot of activity there. And I think what's happened is a lot of the researchers have gotten kind of bored doing the same old, and they want to take their skills and apply them in a new direction. And so I've seen a lot of them work on embedded systems and work on reverse engineering code that's been put on some prom or debug through a JTAG port or something. And so it's really interesting to see people's minds shift and take the same problem-solving skills and apply it to a new domain like hardware or some wireless. And I would encourage you, if you want to kind of see the world in a different light, go check out Christopher Tarnowski's talk. He'll blow your head clean off your skull. Let's see. I want to give you a quick overview of who's here. It's the biggest show ever. We're guessing between 4,000 to 4,500 people, which is pretty enormous. Raise your hand if you think that's enormous. Like 4 people think it's enormous. You're more optimistic than I am. But I can tell you we have one guy here from the Isle of Man. There's one guy here from Bermuda. There's one person admitting to be here from Turkey and Finland. But we've got record numbers of people from Taiwan. The UK sent about 82 people, 11 from Spain, 41 from Norway. Is Norway in the house? Norway? Awesome. And people from 5 continents, one person claiming to be from China. I somehow don't believe that. Don't believe that. Keeping my eyes out for you. Now, some of you might not know this, but South Korea has been sending a team, has been qualifying and making it to the Capture the Flag contest at DEF CON. And this year, they managed to get their whole team into the country. And so we've got 17 people from South Korea as well. So I'd like to welcome them to the show. Tonight, at 6 o'clock when the speaking ends, the reception starts right out here, drinking on us. And we have the second annual Pony Awards. If you guys don't know what this is, you have to check out the Pony Awards. They have new categories from mass ownage to worst vendor disclosure. And they give out these cool little golden ponies. Really cool. Hacker Court is also going on during the reception. So if you want to just get away from all the madness out there, go into the awards, go into the Hacker Court. Go to all the sponsors and bug them for parties, because I know there's quite a few going on tonight. But just try to make it up tomorrow in the morning so you can see the keynote then. I want to thank all of our sponsors for making this possible. As we've grown and prices have gone up, we've needed more and more support. And through them, we've reached larger audiences. And what we're really trying to do is spread the word in a very vendor-neutral way. So out there, you'll say, oh, look at all these sponsors. But when you're in these sessions, you shouldn't be hearing anything about vendor-specific. You know, we want you to be able to ask questions. We want you to be able to challenge the speakers. And really what it's all about is, in the rooms, it's all about knowledge. And it's not really where you come from or what your name is. It's about what's upside your head. And that's the legacy I really try to propagate with Black Hat every year. And so I want to thank you guys for not only helping us select our content, but also making the show a success and keeping the spirit alive. And in that theme, I want you to also try to take some time for us. Fill out your feedback forms. You can win a free admittance to a future Black Hat. We take all that really seriously. We adjust who we invite back as speakers and who we don't. We're going to have a post-Black Hat webinar where we take some of the best of topics and go over them again. So if you miss them, don't worry, there might be another chance. Or the Sound of Source of Knowledge is recording all these sessions. So you can either buy complete anthologies in audio or video. And if you don't want to buy it right now, you can wait 4 or 5 months and we'll put it all online for free. We'll be updating the website tonight and tomorrow and throughout the week with any updated PowerPoint presentations. All that stuff is also free to you to download, share with your colleagues. So, those are mostly all of my administrative questions and giving you guys an update on what we've been doing. I'd like you to stick all your phones on meeting mode, kick back, and get ready to listen to Ian Angel speak. He's an economics professor at the London, or a professor at the London School of Economics. And the press in the UK has sort of dubbed him the Angel of Doom. And he reached, I think, his peaks of infamy when Tony Blair said that he was technologically inept when he dared to question something the wise prime minister had to say once. So he might be a contrarian, but he's definitely very important to listen to. So with that said, I'd like to introduce Ian Angel. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, everyone. Let me start by asking a question that... Let me ask a question that most of you would never ever think of asking. Why do we use technology? Why do we use technology? The reason is that technology imposes structure on our actions, which gives us a tenuous handle on uncertainty. We are swapping hopelessness for the optimism in a plan of action. Uncertainty is transformed into risk, a very trendy topic, risk. A heady mix of hazard and opportunity. I hate the positive side. I stick to the dark side. Whenever I smell flowers, I think funeral. I want to question the prevalent so-called scientific notion of uncertainty and show that today's widespread perception of risk is totally flawed. Many so-called risk managers simply don't understand this. Think how Bear Stearns managed uncertainty. And imagine that Enron ran a management of risk consultancy. I was once at a commercial conference managing uncertainty. I shared the stage with a statistician. He droned on and on about distributions and expectations. I sat there thinking, method is the first, the last, the only resort of the mediocre. The business audience found it inspiring stuff. Within 5 minutes, the eyes began to glaze over. Within 10 minutes, he had an audience of one. I was sitting on the stage. I had to listen to the rubbish. But then, what do I expect? A statistician is someone who wants to work with numbers but doesn't have the personality to be an accountant. Well, if you think about it, statisticians believe in the average human being, and the average human being has one tit and one testicle. Then it was my turn. I walked over to the podium and I just stood there. And I stood there. And I just stood there. I fidgeted, I shot frantic glances at the audience. At first there was silence, then there were a few murmurs. Then a growing rumble of concern. The chairman rose and started to help me. And I went, that's uncertainty. It's got nothing to do with statistics. Business is full of bastards like me pulling stunts. Technology is intrinsically statistical. And then it means it cannot deal with the singularities that emerge spontaneously. When it mixes up with human activity systems. Life is like a poker game. There's a lot of bluffing going on. And players who put their faith in the statistical distribution of the cards are going to lose their shirts. I've learned to play this poker game like my cat, Oscar. Now, Oscar is a very special cat because he can talk. Some friends came visiting recently, and when I told them this, they bet me a 10 to 1. 10-1 that he couldn't. So I called Oscar over.
Meow.
Didn't say a word. So they took my money and left. I was furious. I said, there's no fish for you tonight. And in a very superior voice, because Oscar is a very superior cat, he said, call yourself a professor. Tomorrow night we'll get 100-1. So you have to look beyond statistics, beyond the functionality of technology, beyond the good intentions of the designers, beyond the good and evil, towards the observable consequential risks that occur when computers are integrated into human activity systems. Now, according to a very distinguished colleague of mine, Charles Goodhart, he says any observed statistical regularity will tend to collapse the moment pressure is placed on it for control purposes. An observed regularity is an effect, but the moment you measure it and use that measure as the basis of control, you are making a false assumption that it, the regularity, is the cause of your observation. What Charles is saying is, don't mix up cause and effect. Computers deal with objective, well-structured problems at amazing speed. They deal with detail, but they cannot cope with subjective subtlety, ambiguity, and complexity. A good technology platform, although necessary, is not sufficient. Not sufficient for success. Success and failure is determined by unique political, social, organizational, and particularly personal factors, not just the function. Computers are useless. They only give you answers, mostly to questions you haven't asked. And talking about asking questions about technology, NASA astronaut Mike Collins was asked what went through his mind at blastoff, and he said, I'm sitting on top of 6 million parts, all made by the lowest bidder. We may know the price of the digital technology, but the costs accrue from here to eternity. We have no way of calculating the costs because we don't comprehend the consequences of using the technology. Even if the technology is simple, it becomes highly complex the moment anybody uses it. Grand schemes may solve problems as intended, only to cause worse problems. Any technology, even seemingly benign, can cause problems. They can bite. Consider Fred, the devoted fan of Ella Fitzgerald. His last wish before he died was for Ella to sing Every Time We Say Goodbye at his cremation. The record was placed on the turntable, the stylus was poised over the fourth track, but the wrong side was chosen. What tune do you think accompanied the casket into the incinerator? Too darn hot. With computers too, you can get burned. Systems misbehave. Grand schemes may solve the problem as intended, only to create far worse ones. Systems misbehave. People bandy the word system around without the slightest understanding of what it means. Everywhere the term system is used when referring to mere installations. But a system is what an installation becomes, what it will become, not what it's intended to be. Installations are linear. Systems are intrinsically non-linear. In a linear world, the consequences of an action stops with a reaction. In the non-linear world of practice, unforeseen consequences, so-called systemic risks, both hazards and opportunities, feed back as a result of the inevitable complexity of the interactions implicit when technical installations are mixed with human activity systems. When solving a particular problem, you may or may not succeed, but what is certain is that something completely unexpected will happen. Think of Farmer Jones from North Wales. He grew so sick and tired of RAF fighter planes screaming over his farm and frightening his livestock that he painted "Piss Off Biggles" on his barn roof. Word spread like wildfire among the flyboys. The noise pollution got worse as far more RAF pilots flew over to see it, and the USAF came as well. Another example, the UK Office of Government Commerce spent £14,000 on this corporate logo for their website, mouse mats and pens. According to a spokesman, the OGC is an organisation that is looked upon to have a firm grip on government spend. Now, that's not all they took a grip on. Just turn the logo through 90 degrees. When information systems are mixed with human activity systems, results can be perverse. When you use the tools of technology to solve a particular problem, you may or may not succeed, but what is certain is completely unexpected results occur. Leave that job to computers, and the complexity increases to a point where utility becomes reliance becomes dependence, and a law of diminishing returns precipitates a galloping descent into nightmare. Welcome to the Twilight Zone and the management of information systems. Preposterous claims were made in the early days of every technology. In its pioneering days, electricity was claimed to have a therapeutic effect. Small electric shocks were thought to cure consumption, dysentery, cancer, blindness, worms, impotence. Like the Heidelberg belt. It's like a chastity belt with electrodes. Apparently, small electric shocks to the nether region could increase sexual potency. Of course, we aren't that stupid, are we? Well, what was the dot-com bubble but computerized idiocy? Let's face it, most dot-coms were mail order with delusions of grandeur, a fast access into a shambles. Even the reputable firms were far from perfect. For his 80th birthday, friends of opera fan Fred Harrop ordered a book on Cecilia Bartoli, the famous opera diva. Opening up the packet at the party, what he found was a book containing some very explicit, not to say pornographic, illustrations. They rang up Amazon to complain, only to be told, "Fred's disappointed. Think about the guy who got the opera book." The social networks of so-called Web 2.0 can lead to similar lunacy. Recently divorced Dylan Osborne joined Facebook, looking to kickstart his love life. As usual, the site sent an automatic friend request out to everyone in his email address book. Unfortunately, it included his ex-wife, who had previously taken out a court injunction banning him from contacting her. Although the message was sent without his knowledge, Dylan spent 3 days in jail thanks to Facebook. Only after the nonsense stops can the technology be used propitiously to its full potential. President Pompidou was right. There are three roads to ruin: women, gambling, and technology. Women are the most pleasurable, gambling the quickest, but technology is the most certain. So will technology lead to ruin? Who knows? We may be damned if we do, but we're doubly damned if we don't. Take the advice of Machiavelli. On his deathbed, the priest was delivering the last rites. "Do you renounce the devil and all his works?" To which Machiavelli replied, "This is no time to be making enemies." Never take this diabolical technology for granted. If you become complacent, and computers will really screw you up, along with the surrounding human activity systems. See, in the good old days, before Sarbanes-Oxley, those in positions of authority in a firm had limited responsibility and little or no liability for their actions. They could be highly imaginative with company books because they had little or no liability. Nowadays, when the CEO signs off the accounts, he has sleepless nights. Get it wrong and the jail cell beckons. Their personal freedom is now at risk, and this focuses the collective mind of every board of directors. They've all seen Jeff Skilling of Enron being carted off to jail in handcuffs. No wonder computer security grabs their attention. Now it's personal. Now it's serious. Who knows what incriminating documents will pop out of the computer in the present financial crisis? Around budget time, smiling chief security officers can be heard quoting that great American philosopher Richard Nixon, "When you've got them by the balls, their hearts and minds will follow." So never put anything on a computer that you wouldn't want the whole world to see, because they will see it. Potential employers are scanning the web to check out job applicants. HR departments are uncovering incriminating evidence posted long ago on social networks. Disloyal comments on past employers, or the release of their confidential information, the use of inappropriate screen names, sloppy or lewd vocabulary, even a poor writing style can all lead to a rejection slip. And as for emails, I teach my students always to use them as defensive weapons. The buck doesn't stop here with authority. It stops anywhere that authority can dump it. Never take a verbal statement at face value. Note it down and email it straight back, asking for clarification. Now it's on the record. Now you've proof that wrongdoing lies elsewhere. Ensure that all commitments or agreements are conditional. Forget the business school nonsense that companies are full of rational people with unified aims. Let's take a reality check. Most managers are liars, cheats, fools, incompetents, psychopaths, all with their own agendas. Just ask Dilbert. Always view an organizational chart like a tree full of monkeys. The people at the top look down and see monkeys. The people at the bottom look up and see assholes. Practice the art of plausible deniability in your emails. Set up audit trails to cover your tracks and your backs. When blame is flying around, use emails to make sure that the buck doesn't stop with you, but anywhere you can dump it with that poor sap at the end of the audit trail, because that's what the other guy is doing. And to think, not very long ago, computer applications were seen as groundbreaking, fundamentally changing the nature of work, signaling the advent of the information revolution. Unfortunately, every revolution evaporates and leaves behind only the slime of a new bureaucracy. The real problem, though, is not computerized bureaucracy per se, but its expansion into inappropriate areas. Quite reasonably, firms aspire to bureaucracy, as it is the most effective way of controlling normal problematic situations, thereby mitigating the risk. However, in singular situations, the unilateral imposition of predetermined rules of bureaucracy can lead to chaos. Look at what happened to Wookiee Hole. It's a UK tourist centre. It's a great place for a day out. I can thoroughly recommend it. They were launching a brand new attraction, a grand teddy bear exhibition. Their insurance company insisted that the premises be patrolled at night by a guard dog. A risk-based analysis indicated that their lone night watchman was not sufficient to guard such a valuable collection. Left with no choice, they hired Barney the Doberman. So far, so good. Except for a simple oversight. When they're training Dobermans, they use soft toys. The presence of a mountain of fluffy toys turned a normal situation into a singularity. Mabel, the show's star exhibit, a stiff bear once owned by Elvis Presley, didn't stand a chance. Barney tore her to shreds, along with the other bears. The insurance company had to pay £40,000 just for Mabel. And all because the risk assessors, in their bureaucratic certainty, demanded a guard dog. Computerized bureaucracy can degenerate into chaos. The American Psychology Society says that the omnipresent computer screens distract and cause confusion and errors of judgment. They call it the glass cockpit syndrome. No one is immune. From the novice user to the most sophisticated computer professional and hackers. The hackers think they're smart. Complexity will shaft them along with everyone else. This syndrome has two effects. End users rarely rely entirely on the system without exercising any judgment, and the ensuing information overload results in them ignoring many pieces of sometimes very important information. See, computer bureaucracy is highly efficient and effective in normal situations. However, we cannot know if a situation is normal until after the consequences have played out. The inappropriate use of bureaucracy can be mitigated, but only by using discretion. Unfortunately, bureaucracy often signals the end of discretion. Discretion is frowned on. Since bureaucracy, in its self-referential certainty, claims that everything is normal and thus under control. However, in inevitable abnormal singular situations, a lack of discretion leads to a vicious circle of hazard. Bureaucracies are self-referential systems. They operate on their own terms. In a bureaucracy, all decisions and choices have been made well in advance, with each situation seen as normal, along with a self-referential insistence that there are no abnormal situations. But there are always singular situations that don't fit the rules. And yet, we tend to accept what we are told by a computer system, rather than admit the contradictory evidence of our own eyes. You may be wondering why, if I feel this way, do I still teach my students about computerized methods? Well, for very much the same reason as medical professors teach their students about venereal disease. I show them firms throwing telephone number sums into the bottomless money pit of computing. The black hole of information technology, forgetting Dennis Healy's first law of politics. When you're in a hole, stop digging. I tell them to heed Moondog's words, the blind, eccentric New York poet. What I say now, I say without condition, that science is but the latest, greatest superstition. Information technology is just the latest technological adventure whereby man feels he can subjugate nature by mere will. But new technology owes ecology an apology. It's madness. Madness is something rare in individuals, but in groups, parties, peoples, ages, it is the rule. The madness of our particular age is the delusion that our world can be controlled and managed by using the pseudoscience of technology. This is the madness of control freaks. Behind many of their computer applications is the malignant belief that human thought is mere calculation. We are biological analog computers. There is a sinister hidden agenda stemming from the dominance of two ideas: that a number can be a meaningful representation of human experience, and that arithmetic operations such on all of these representations implemented on a computer can produce rational decisions about and can control the human condition. This resulting brave new world will not be one of ordered, constrained, and controlled lives, but a rule-based bureaucratic shambles. When the control freaks, see, what the control freaks don't appreciate is that their actions actually trigger an uncertainty principle. There's no point in measuring something that will change the moment it's measured, even because it's being measured. Like in Britain, the nonsense over healthcare targets. Surgeons actually push dying patients out into the corridor so that their death in surgery figures are kept low. That's the nonsense that's going on. Pointing mathematical instruments at complexity in a nonlinear world of practice can only create instability, where the only certainty is uncertainty. Take the personalization technology of profiling, being used everywhere to predict, for example, the tastes of consumers by tracking what they buy, watch, or listen to. Mike Binder, the TV star, set his TiVo to record his 1999 movie, The Sex Monster. It was about a man whose wife was bisexual. TiVo profiled him as gay and sent him a steady stream of gay programming. He counteracted by recording the Playboy channel. TiVo eventually stopped sending him gay material, but Mike's wife was not amused. What we ought to do with profiling is to all of us have our own crawlers, and then when we're not using the internet, send it out, go visit every site everywhere, so the profiler we have is full of garbage, and then they will stop bothering us with their profiles. Do they really imagine that we can control our complex world by computerizing the arbitrary use of numbers, statistics, measurement, with profiling, with systems analysis, with opinion polls, market research, socioeconomic classifications, performance measures, efficiency audits, cost-benefit analysis? See, the basis of decision-taking has shifted to a numerical justification, and the lust for numerical solutions is spreading. Everywhere I see the assignment of numbers to the future. Strategy becomes a matter of controlling the future by labeling it with numbers, rather than by continually reevaluating the uncertain situation and by depending on people, which is the sensible option. Searching for the right numerical label to represent the future is no different to numerology and astrology or the personality tests found in women's magazines. You know, answer 20 questions and you can find the color of your future husband's eyes. Computerization is just as nonsensical. And putting the data on a computer amplifies the errors. Enter the Peter Principle. Individuals and computers are promoted to beyond their level of competence to their level of incompetence. But computers are worse because they magnify and amplify the incompetence of all around. It's easy to forget that numbers are not objective, but reflect an act of choice, a hidden agenda, a prejudged priority, some preconceived notion of category. And this leads me to another Oscar story. You remember him? Well, I commute by train, and the railway station is 4 bus stops away from my home. And returning from work, I just missed a bus, so I ran after it. It came to a halt at the bus stop in the distance, and I almost got there. It took off again. So I kept running, it stopped in the distance, I almost got there, it took off again. I thought, oh, to hell with it. I gave up and I walked the rest of the way home. So I go in the house, I kissed the cat and told to my wife that I'd run all the way home, but I had saved £1.20. Oscar looked at me in his pathetic look and said, "Call yourself a professor. why didn't you chase a taxi? You would have saved £5. But I can hear you say the figures don't lie. Not according to Mark Twain. It's not the figures lying, but the liars figuring. Ask any manager at budget time. Numbers do lie. Numbers are like people. Torture them enough and they will tell you anything. Underneath all numerical methods is a belief in atomism, in category. However, category is not truth. It is merely a choice that it's okay to treat similarity, things that are similar, as if they are the same. But nothing is the same. The world is made up of unique things. But when you treat similarity as sameness and then assume that all comparisons between these ideal forms are absolute facts, you have a problem. But as time moves on, or the perspective changes, or the environment changes, category eventually changes, and all of your models fail. And the trouble is, we are trapped, because that's what human beings do. Categories are our way of differentiating meaning. But as a category changes, meaning changes. All data is context sensitive. There are no such things as absolute facts. A fact is like a sack. It won't stand up until you put something into it. Nuances of detail, as well as deliberate, accidental, and arbitrary actions, feed back to continuously modify, amplify elements and processes and subsystems. Squeezing complex human experience into a straitjacket of categories that is needed for computerization is forcing square pegs into round holes. This sheds a debris of detail that conspires with the context to form a critical mass and a subsequent explosion from the capricious division and fragmentation in the flux of events that is life. What I'm saying is that the only thing that systems have in common is that they all fail. And the fault, see, failure is inevitable, but the fault lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. That fault is in the way we humans categorize what we observe in the world. Well, now, prepare yourself. Now comes the really heavy, boring bit. The fallacy of residual category. When we categorize, when we computerize, we separate each thing, each data object, from everything else. We separate a thing from its complement, its residual category. You see, everything has a residual category. That's what we do. And in that way, we can model and therefore control the world with our science and technology. But what we're doing is we restrict access to that thing. When we categorize, we restrict it. However, according to Nicholas Luhmann, the concept of environment should not be misunderstood as a kind of residual category. Instead, relationship to the environment is constitutive in system formation. What he's saying is that there are tacit properties of the whole, latencies, which are not apparent in any component part. When we focus on a category, we lose the latencies. Any one component is structurally coupled to the world, to everything else. However, by bringing that one part to the fore, observing it as a standalone thing, item, the couplings are cut by the distinctions that are implied in the separation of observation, and the latency vanishes. Let me illustrate this with a diagram. These are the Borromean rings. The rings are three interlinked circles that, because of their topology, are inseparable as a triple. The special characteristic of these rings lies in the fact that no two of them are linked as a result. If you distinguish one of the rings, the red one, then the structural coupling is lost. If we move it away, you can see what's happened. We've lost the latency. Thus, structural couplings, latencies, are made to disappear. So whenever you create a database, what you're doing is destroying latencies. And the two parts, the thing and its residual category, no longer compromise the original whole. And what you've done is introduce a paradox. For in the original whole, the two artificially separated parts continue to operate and interrelate as the unobservable whole. Because of this asymmetry between the world as it is and the world as we observe it with our categories, observation is conditional, but those conditions are necessarily unobservable, unappreciable, uncertain. Those truncated structural couplings, so casually discarded by our categorization, by our observation, stay on as uncertainties and thus as risks to the observer in any further observation. And they can reassert themselves in the most inconvenient ways. And we are back to uncertainty and risk. So whenever we use a database, whenever we categorize, we always introduce new uncertainty. And so we are confronted by the most inconvenient fact. By introducing structure that turns uncertainty into risk, we have distinguished the world into categories. And in doing so, we introduce new paradoxes and yet more and far more subtle uncertainties, which then lead on to future risks, as yet unstructured. Such is the human condition, and there's no escape. Initially, the paradoxes are aligned. They have to be aligned because that's how we saw the pattern in the first place. But as the system gets bigger, as time moves on, that alignment will falter. The paradoxes will ultimately conspire to form a pollution and will upset the system. All computer systems are intrinsically flawed and can only ever have a transitory utility. This has got nothing to do with the quality of the design. Being smug in your expertise with computer installations won't help you in the slightest, because the flaw has got nothing to do with computers and everything to do with the way systems work. And it's a fallacy implicit in all human categorization of data. And if you place faith in computerized systems, it's asking for trouble. Like the headmaster of an English private school who had spent a fortune on a new computer laboratory. Proudly, he set about having every letter word processed, including invoices for school fees. But unfortunately, the word annual was spelt with a single N. No problem, put it into the spell checker and use the thesaurus to find the nearest word that fitted. So the letter went out, the anal charge will be. One humorous parent replied, "It makes a change, we normally pay through the nose." The act of imposing a computerized tidiness on an untidy world can lead to chaos. A blind belief in perfecting computer installations is folly. Take, for example, biometric databases aimed at identifying and catching criminals. Television programs like CSI trumpet the myth of forensic investigators vacuuming up biological material from the scene of crime, comparing DNA samples with a computerized database, and out pops the criminal's name. End of story. Nothing is that simple. Low-paid hospital staff will be compromised to sell samples of blood and skin and saliva and other biological material. Aspiring criminals undertaking a crime will randomly scatter arbitrary collections of DNA material and cigarette ends that they pick up on their last night out. The criminal scene will be totally compromised. The whole system of DNA profiling will be compromised. You see, the epistemology underlying large socially engineered databases is misconceived. Because of the fallacy of residual categories, all database queries hold the potential for false positives, where innocent people are identified as guilty. Like Brandon Mayfield from Oregon, who was charged with being involved in the 2004 Madrid bombing, which is based on spurious fingerprint match. The FBI ended up paying him $2 million. But there are control freaks everywhere who think they can capture the identities of whole populations in a biometric database. And four control freaks read politicians who treat the world as would a newborn baby. They make demands at one end and take no responsibility for what happens at the other. These politicians really should be changed frequently, like diapers, and for much the same reason. They're full of SH1T. The British government, Tony Blair, who called me technologically inept, the idiot, subscribes to the pixie dust school of technology. They think that computerization is a magic dust that they sprinkle over problems for something wonderful to happen. No surprise, then, that Britain has an appalling record of slippage, price overruns, and a failure of large IT projects. These idiot politicians are now proposing an ID project, one of the biggest installations ever envisaged. Of course, the politicians themselves won't have their photographs on their ID cards because no one can decide which of their two faces to use. They want a computerized register of the whole population, which they claim will help prevent identity theft and catch terrorists. Listen, and you can hear President Reagan, the 9 most terrifying words in the English language. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help. John Lennon was right. Our society is being run by insane people for insane objectives. I think we're run by maniacs for maniacal ends. There's only one way to look at a politician, and that's down. A politician will double-cross any bridge he comes across, so that he always will be there on both sides when he needs you. Criminals take the money and run. Politicians run and take the money. Parliament is like a bunch of bananas, not a straight one among them. In Holland, carrying an ID card is compulsory. An 80-year-old woman went out to take some illicit plant cuttings near her home. She was caught by an official and fined 100 euros. She didn't have her ID card with her, so she was fined another 100 euros. And when she got angry, naturally, she was fined another 100 euros. ID cards bring another terrorist to justice. Everywhere, officious officials can't wait to misuse their powers. So now you know why the Times calls me the Angel of Doom and the Guardian calls me the Guru of Gloom. But I don't want you to go away thinking that I'm a pessimist. Pessimists think the glass is half empty. Optimists say the glass is half full. I'm a capitalist. They're using too much glass. As a capitalist, everywhere I look, I see silver linings among the dark clouds. Of course, there are countless benefits from technology, but only for those who adhere to sensible, pragmatic strategies. There's huge money to be made from this vast gravy train. But never forget, digital technology is part of the problem, not part of the solution. There are no solutions, only contingencies. Whenever anyone tells you that information is good, more information is better, and computerized information is best, reach for the straitjacket. Only neurotics think that they can use technology to control the uncertainty implicit in the real world. When a man has a watch, he knows the time. If he has two watches, he isn't so sure. So for those of you who still haven't recognized the importance of complexity, then I have just one more piece of advice. Start the day with a smile and get it over with. Because you've got nothing to smile about. But as for us cynics in the computer security business, we'll be laughing all the way to the bank. Thank you very much.